All right, so welcome. So this month I am focusing on the Four Noble Truths. And so last week we talked about the first noble truth, the truth of that there is dukkha. There's a quality of unsatisfactoriness, of a sense of things not quite fitting quite right, that kind of a difficulty. And tonight we're going to talk about the second noble truth. Now, two themes I want to bring out throughout this month are one, that these noble truths are really a hologram of each other. As we experience one, or as we understand one, we start to see it in context of the other. So they all inform each other. One aspect contains the other aspects. We start to see that as we go further and further along in these Four Noble Truths. The other theme I want to emphasize is the immediacy of this practice, that it's not something that we can just understand intellectually, but we actually have to bring it into our daily meditation, and it, more importantly, into our life, how we actually meet moments of difficulty, of struggle, and see the release of that difficulty. So seeing how it's in the moment, each moment's arising, each moment's unfolding, there's a chance to bring forth the wisdom that we learn through understanding these Four Noble Truths. So just to review last week a little bit, so the first noble truth, the truth that there is dukkha. So dukkha, I purposely didn't translate it because when we translate it as suffering or as stress or as difficulty, our minds have a certain picture that comes up around that. We may think, well, my life doesn't have a lot of suffering right now. Things are going pretty well. Or sometimes when our life is very difficult, you know, we think, okay, that's really what I need to look at. But if you define dukkha, including that kind of ordinary suffering, the suffering that we all experience, you know, pain, physical pain, mental pain, emotional pain, loss, these are the ordinary suffering that we all have to work with, all have to deal with. Then there's the secondary resistance to that, what's often called the second dart, when we add more suffering on top of that original suffering. But if we expand dukkha to include the axis isn't quite fitting right on the wheel. The wheel is a little wobbly, right? So going through life with this kind of bumpy relationship to experience, that no matter how much we try to get things lined up just right, it never quite fits. You know, we try to get things just the way you want it and something changes. So the three aspects of dukkha, one is that there's this ordinary dukkha, the ordinary suffering of the physical body, having being a human. But there's also the dukkha of change, that we tend to build our lives on something that we think is going to be solid. You know, I hope this relationship, this job, this health will never change. And like we're building our hopes on sand that's being eroded slowly. And we experience that erosion, there is a quality of dukkha that arises with that argument with how things are. So the third kind of dukkha is that of conditioned states, of conditioned things. So everything is conditioned. Conditioned meaning that it's not just arising by itself, but there's things that come to support it in certain arising. You can see that in your own mind and body, that you may feel you have a good meal and you feel satiated or may feel sleepy. That sleepiness came from eating. And that's what's conditioned also falls away. Now, where the dukkha really shows up is this includes a sense of who we are, who we take ourselves to be. You know, we have embed our sense of identity in these different shapes based on our conditions of our life, who we're talking to, what our jobs are. But those conditions are always changing, so therefore the identity is always changing. So there's a certain rub that's always happening with that. And then last week, we ultimately looked at dukkha as whenever we're holding ourselves outside of the natural unfolding of life. So each moment's experience, you know, we hear sound, we see things, smell, we have thoughts arising, and they're constantly arising, constantly falling away. It's a constant flux, rising and falling away. Now, when we hold ourselves outside of that, when we think we are something solid that's able to observe that and experience that, that holding, that little distance, is a form of dukkha. In some ways, it's the most fundamental form of dukkha. But when we're able to include ourselves, our own sense of who we are, in that arising and falling away, then there's this natural harmony that starts to come, that starts to arise. So we allow this sense of even observer, the sense of who is it watching, be part of that flow of arising and passing away. And as we hold ourselves outside of that, as we have this sense of, I want this to be a certain way, we will experience a quality of dukkha with that. So the homework from last week hopefully pointed toward that for you, to start to notice how when you relate to life as this natural unfolding and allow yourself to be part of that unfolding, there's this qualities of harmony, there's a quality of peace that comes from that, of ease. On the other hand, when we hold ourselves outside of that, when we push that away, there's difficulty that arises. It's like we're trying to hold something that's naturally dissolving in our hands. So this brings us to the second noble truth, and the truth of the arising of dukkha, or the origination of dukkha. Now, very simply put, the origination of dukkha is considered the Pali word of tanha, which is translated often as thirst, or as hunger, or as desire, a sense of wanting. One translation is hankering, that sense of like wanting something. And it gets tricky with our language, our English language, when you hear those words of desire or craving or wanting, or even thirst and hunger. There's a certain image that comes up with that. That's something I think in some ways undercuts the real significance of the thirst that is implied by tanha. We can think of it as, you know, I just have this craving that I can easily dismiss. If I was more stronger willed, I wouldn't have that craving. Or I just need to indulge in it, and there was no problem. I want a candy bar, I'll just go buy one, and there's no difficulty with that. But there's actually a much more profound understanding of what this thirst means, what this tanha means, that I hope we can explore tonight and get a better sense. Because from that tanha, from that sense of thirst, that sense of insufficiency, really, that drives our actions, our way we look at life, that's where the dukkha originates from. And so we understand that dukkha and the origin of dukkha become very interrelated in that understanding. Now, there's three types of dukkha that the Buddha spoke of. So we'll explore those and try to bring them into our modern life a little bit more. So the first one is the thirst for sense pleasure. Okay, the thirst for sense pleasure. The second one is the thirst for becoming, for existence. The third one is the thirst for non-existence. All right, so there's three kinds of thirst or of hunger that drive us, that create this quality of dukkha. So let's unpack those a little bit more and explore those. So the first one, the thirst for sense pleasure. Now, I like the word thirst because it does give a sense of this urgency in ourselves, like we really need this substance to help us feel better, feel satiated. There's this hunger that drives us. So if you ever felt really hungry, or maybe your blood sugars crashed, or you're really thirsty, there's that hunger for something that's really driving you. Because that quality of thirst, as we'll explore it from sense pleasure, but we'll take that same understanding and explore it to these more subtle aspects of tanha, the thirst to become, the thirst to not become. I think it's also important to notice that right at the beginning that this quality of tanha, we often think of it as this desire, this wanting. It's also the opposite side is also true, the not wanting. The pushing away is also a cause of dukkha. You have this deep desire not to have this experience, not to be having this sense in my body, not to have this thought, not to have this smell or this person in front of me. And as I lay those two out, we have to be careful not to slip into self-judgment, right? self-criticism around, okay, I'm feeling I have this desire, I should get rid of this desire. It's like we have this whole overlay of our, perhaps our Christian heritage that we really live in this country, that often has this quality of guilt and shame that comes up. In practice, in Dharma practice, we're not trying to, whenever you have this sense of judgment, you're not able to fully see what is being judged. It's like there's this way that your attention becomes very narrow and just interfacing with one part of it. So when you feel that judgment, it's important to really notice the judgment, not to judge the judgment, but to try to relax around it, to try to see whatever you're judging more fully, to let it into your heart, really. Because when we judge, we push it away as something other. And in that pushing away, we close ourselves to seeing it and fully understanding it. And through that full seeing and understanding, that's where the liberation comes, not through trying to make ourselves one way or another way. Also, when we think of desire as something that we should get rid of, willpower naturally comes up. I just need to white knuckle it and deal with it. Kabir spoke of it this way. I gave up sewn clothes and wore a robe, but I noticed one day the cloth was well woven. So I bought some burlap, but I still threw it elegantly over my left shoulder. I pulled back my sexual longings, and now I discover that I'm angry a lot. I gave up rage, but now I notice that I am greedy all day. I worked hard at dissolving the greed, and now I am proud of myself. When the mind wants to break this link with the world, it still holds on to one thing. When the mind wants to break its link with the world, it still holds on to one thing. So the mind trying to break the link, to try to stop desire, it just something else pops up. So that's why this practice requires a depth of honesty with ourselves to really see what's our motivation. You know, when is there incongruence with what we're thinking we should be doing and the tension in our body? You know, so when there's that tension or that sense of dissonance, then we wake up, we pay more attention to what's here, listen to those deeper belief system that's there. You know, find a different way of relating to this experience. Then it's not about cramming ourselves into the right box, the right shape, but actually allowing a more full, natural expression of being human. Now, tanha has a real strong action, potential for action that's associated with it. We often kind of actually conflate these two things of desire and action as being one and the same. I mean, the desire, we think desire is just telling us what we need to do to get what we want. You know, I want this, I'm going to start to act in getting it. I mean, how often have you been finding yourself reaching for that extra cookie without even realizing that you wanted it? It's like the desire comes up and the action flows right from that. You know, in beginning meditation classes, we often have people, actually all the way through, to sit, you know, try to sit still and not to move with the reaction of the impulses, like to scratch something. And when that not moving on that scratching, you start to feel what it really feels like to itch. And you understand there's a difference between the itch, the impulse to act on the itch, and the actual action of actually scratching that. And even that's something that's so simple, why not just scratch? By unpacking it that way, slowing it down, you start to really learn these distinct components that can have an experience that I want to do something about in the moment, but I can also just hold it. I can just experience it. And in that experiencing it, there's a freedom that comes in. Okay, so when it's not longer an itch, but it's a harsh word you want to say to someone, an email you want to write, you know, some action you want to say, you'll be able to come back and connect in the body and realize this is just, I can hold this intensity. So with action, I think it's very helpful when we start to look at tanha to start to suspend the action from the actual experience of desire or craving or wanting of this hunger. So this asks us, when we're able to do that, it allows us to, if we're willing to really take the experience of hunger in much more fully, to really step into it instead of just acting from it. When we act from it, we're not fully seeing it. It's like we're being driven by it. But when we're able to not act from it, at least for the moment, we're able to connect more deeply with the actual experience. What does it really feel like? Fully opening to it means to be fully within it. And to think of it like a fast-moving stream. Okay, so our desires are this fast-moving stream, this tanha. And usually when this stream is activated, we just jump on it and we get swept down to the object that we're desiring. Whether it's a person, a experience, a thing, an object, a state of a being, or who we want to be, or a sense of identity, a thought. These are all forms of tanha, or objects of it. Usually we get so focused on the object, we get right into that stream. Now imagine instead of getting swept down the stream, you just step inside the stream without getting swept down, but feel the water moving through your body, across your body, the debris and twigs and things like that. And that's what it feels like if you're holding the tanha without acting from it. You're feeling it very intensely. In some ways more directly than you perhaps have ever felt it before. But if you stay with that, something starts to shift. And you start to develop this confidence to not be driven by the tanha, by this hunger. So then nothing becomes between you and the experience. Nothing comes between you and what's actually happening. So you can see how we get so distracted by the object, what we want, what we don't want. Instead of feeling the actual sense of not wanting, the sense of wanting. Now when we do that, we start to notice the relationship to thought, how thought has such a, it can have a very obsessive quality, a very driven quality when we're really fixated on something that we really need or something that we really don't want in our life. How can I get rid of this? Our thoughts just go over and over and again. Almost the thought allows us to float a little bit outside reality because we're not connected to what's actually happening. We're caught in the story of what it means. And if you're not acting on it, you can see, what is the story, what is the thing, the benefit that you think this thing will give me? You know, and just to take that in and say, is this new car going to really bring me this lasting happiness, the lasting prestige that I think it will? So this first one, the tanha, the sense pleasure, it's not about denying and being cut off from anything pleasurable in life. It's about really understanding, you know, the benefits and the limitations of it. So we can still experience pleasure and joy in our life. You know, actually we can experience more fully if we are not so driven by the tanha. Working with the edge of this, playing with it a little bit, helps us to understand what does it really feel like to desire something, to really want something. Again, desiring is also not wanting to. It can be both sides. So you can really feel what it is in our body. How does it show up in our senses, and our body senses, and our minds, and our emotionality? So then we can start to recognize it in these more subtle levels of tanha that we're going to be going into. In some ways, they're not so much more subtle, but they're just we're more identified with them. It's much more close to who we take ourselves to be, these deeper levels of tanha. But practicing with the simple things in life, we recognize I'm wanting something, recognizing what it feels like, then we can start to see, oh, this deeper sense is also the same quality of desire, of thirst. So if we just stay at this level of sense pleasures, that's all as far as we go, there's this whole unseen thirst that's operating that we're not seeing, this unconscious quality. It's really creating a sense of ownership, a sense of identification with what we're wanting. And so the next two types of dukkha explore that and start to unpack those. So that was the thirst for sense pleasure. So the second two, the thirst for existence and becoming. So existence and becoming. So in some ways that can seem like a, a strange thirst because we all, you know, obviously we already exist, right? We're already here. But if we look at it from a Buddhist standpoint, we see that the sense of who we are is constantly arising and constantly falling away. It's like it gets loaded based on the conditions of our life, based on our past programming and history. All that comes together, a sense of self pops up to meet what's here, and then there's the release of that. It falls away as a new thing arises. So this is the subtle wanting to take form, wanting to have a sense of identity, wanting to be seen as this kind of a person. You often notice it when you don't have, when that's not affirmed, when someone says, you know, you're a selfish person and you feel like you're very generous. Okay, you see the dissonance there. Shows it more clearly there. Or someone praises you and you feel, oh, I feel really good about myself. If you look underneath that, there's a deeper hunger to form into that type of a person, that type of a being. You know, who we take ourselves to be. The thirst to not be, the thirst to non-exist, is just the flip side of this. So I don't want to be seen as this kind of person. I don't want to be this part I judge about myself. This is often called the shadow parts of ourselves that we deny and we push away. So both of these forms of thirst, of wanting to become and wanting to not become, form the undercurrent of all the tanha, of all the thirst. It's really the essence of this hunger. Because the objects are just the superficial expression of it. You know, we get really distracted. We spend our lives. If we listen to the advertisements and marketing, that's really where our energy is directed toward. You're getting the next experience, the next thing. But if you look deeper, we see that underneath that there's a deeper need to want to be something, to feel good about ourselves, to feel happy. And this deeper hunger. If we understand that, then the deeper qualities start to transform dukkha in a very profound way. So when I talk about becoming and not becoming, the hunger to be and to not be is really sides of the same coin, the same thing. Think of it like a magnetized needle, like if you're making a compass. So it's got the one end's always pointing toward the north. So that's the desire to be. Okay, the other end's always pointing toward the south. That's the desire not to be. They're part of the same process. It's really the fact that this needle is magnetized. That's what's always making it shift. So that sense of being magnetized is really that. That movement toward the north or south is this movement of craving, of desire, of wanting. Whether it's going toward or against, it's just the same process, just the different side of it. So what polarizes that needle? What makes it magnetized? You know, what creates this quality of dukkha, or not dukkha, of tanha, of craving? And also a related question is, how does tanha lead to dukkha? So this is a point where we can really unpack it with the teaching of dependent origination, which I think is too much to try to go into right now. But just to briefly talk about it. So in the moment, when you're feeling this desire, you're wanting something, and when you recognize, I really want something, it didn't just arise out of nowhere, right? You had to have something that you want. Okay, so there had to be some contact with it, meaning you've sensed it through your sense doors. It could be a thought about it. There had to be a quality of it being pleasant or unpleasant. All right, and there's that's called Vedana. And then from there we launch into the wanting of it, wanting more of it. Now, all that piece kind of happens in this present moment. Right? So I ring the bell, it's the end of the meditation. Okay, there's a pleasant, you like that sound because it means you can stretch your legs. From there, you know, then maybe there's that craving that can build from that. But why did that bell get associated in that way? It's because of your past history. If you've never heard the bell, you might just hear it as a pleasant sound, or maybe an unpleasant sound. So there's our past conditioning from our families of origin, our culture, our religion, our gender, all these things come in to create how we interpret life, right? And so that's kind of this pre-programming that arises into this moment. It's interesting, when you look more closely, that pre-programming is created through our past, really our past dukkha, our experiences with difficulty that come up. So you can see there's this constant loop. And once we get familiar with this experiential quality of dukkha, what does it really, or not dukkha, but tanha, this quality of thirst, what does it really feel like in the moment? Then we can start to look at these more subtle qualities of wanting to become or not to become. And there's three expressions of tanha I like to explore, and these aren't an exclusive list. There's other ones too. The first one is this hunger to control. Have you ever felt like you wanted to control life, have things be a certain way? That sense of trying to be on time and trying to have everything lined up. Because it's a constantly losing battle, because life's always eroding a little bit, always changing. No matter how much we try to line things up, the stock market falls. You know, our health fails for the time being. And so this hunger to control, just to notice, you can start to notice in your life when you start to want things to be a certain way. And so instead of acting on that object, come back into that sense of wanting, right? So if you can recognize that as tanha, you can start to see this deeper hunger that's there. And if you can be still with it and be quiet with it, then it starts to loosen up that need to always be in control. Start to go more into this unfolding of life. And this way, it starts to free up this spontaneity of how to relate to life as it's naturally arising, instead of how we think it should arise. Natural qualities of intimacy start to arise with that also. So this hunger to try to control things, to be in control. The second hunger is the hunger to be right, to be correct, to be on the right side of things. This is often seen as this desire to have of our views, our ideas, our opinions. This time of year, you can really see the desire to be right with the politicians, right? So just whatever side of the spectrum that you happen to be, when you look at the opposite side, notice how you know that they're wrong, right? You know that they're wrong and you're right. Okay, so instead of taking that on face value, and if you look underneath that, there's a deeper hunger to want to be right or wrong. And underneath that is the hunger to start, is to really become, to take shape in that belief system, in that view of what you think is true. So a very challenging practice is to listen to someone who you really disagree with. You know, instead of just, you know, judging them and shutting them up and not waiting to interrupt them and say how wrong they are, just let their side in a little bit. What helps with this is if you realize that letting it in is not the same thing as acting from it. Okay, so we can let in an opposite view, an opposite perspective, but realizing that's not the same thing as acting from that perspective. This again goes back to earlier, we talked about how our desires, our actions, are really connected with our actions. We desire something, we act from it. We desire to have this opinion, and we act from it. Now these are much more subtle because we take them really as being true. You know, so it's challenging us to be very subtle with our practice. Sometimes it's helpful just to ask yourself, would I rather be happy or right? Because, you know, if I really want to be right, I'm not often very happy. If I'm willing to let go of my view, then there's a happiness that can arise from that. So I'm hoping that by looking at sense pleasure and just that natural hunger that arises for desire, you can start to connect that with this hunger to be right, the hunger to have this opinion, to have this belief, to really take form in that. It's the same mechanism, it's more subtle because it's our intellect, and also our minds and our thoughts that we take much more personally. And the third type of hunger is this hunger to have a place of reference, to have a location. Now this is in some ways the most subtle aspect, and it underlies these other qualities of hunger. So just as you're sitting there, just notice how there's a natural sense of you looking out, that you look out and you know, okay, here I am and here you are, and here's all the space I am. And just notice as your eyes wander around, you see something, okay, I see a statue, that I label that as a Buddha. I see a cushion and a label comes up. So that process of labeling, the process of having a perspective that we're looking out from, is all this very subtle quality of tanha, of thirst to be, to become. Now, what if you were able to see without adding a label to it, without adding a sense of identification with it? If you're able to experience yourself, like get a sense of who you are, you know, the kind of work you do, the relationships, the roles that you have in your life. And if you close your eyes for a moment and just go into this actual sense of the body sitting, notice how those roles, if you let it, fade away. They disappear in the moment. And so there's a very deep hunger to want to have that positionality, to have this sense of this is where I'm coming from. And so it has a very, very close, subtle reference point. You know, and this also takes many external forms. You know, when you look at how our culture is, you know, what our culture of our assumptions of how things should be versus how they shouldn't be, around time, around money, or authority, all these cultural things that we've assumed as being true. These are these qualities of reference. Gender, you know, how do we take it with gender? What's the role of a female versus a male? You know, where do I fit in that spectrum? These are all forms of referencing that we take. Our race, you know, our orientation. You know, what do we assume is the normal versus what's actually the reality of it. So all these are very subtle qualities that we just assume as being true. So to understand this, how dukkha really takes such a root and so pervasive in our life, we have to understand these subtle qualities of hunger, of wanting to be in this position. Now you might be sensing it, but to really be free of dukkha means we have to be willing to release our deep perspectives, our deep position, our sense of identity. Naomi Shihab Nye in The Art of Disappearing said it this way. When they say, "Don't I know you?" say no. When they invite you to the party, remember what parties are like before answering. Someone is telling you in a loud voice they once wrote a poem, greasy sausage balls on a paper plate. Then reply. If they say, "We should get together," say, "Why?" It's not that you don't love them anymore. You're trying to remember something too important to forget. Trees, the monastery bell at twilight. Tell them that you have a new project. It will never be finished. When someone recognizes you in a grocery store, nod briefly and become a cabbage. When someone you haven't seen in 10 years appears at the door, don't start singing him all your new songs. You will never catch up. Walk around feeling like a leaf. Know that you could tumble any second, and then decide what to do with your time. The Art of Disappearing by Naomi Shihab Nye. Dukkha and the cause of dukkha, the real origin of dukkha. It comes back again and again for me for this unfolding of this moment. This moment's always unfolding and always unfolding, arising and passing away. And when we hold ourselves outside of that, we experience dukkha. The reason we hold ourselves out is because of this hunger, this sense of taking claim, putting down, this is who I am, this is what I believe. Even as subtle as I am seeing this, I am experiencing this, is still a form of taking shape. So it becomes very subtle. You know, I like to go down to the ocean, and often you can see there's a place where the river's coming down. And the interface where there's the sand coming up that's been accumulated by the beach, when the sand, the river is cutting down and the stream's cutting through that sand. And right in the edge of that, there's a little bit of a mini cliff. So sometimes you can stand on that edge and feel the cliff start to collapse under your feet. Okay. So the quality of collapsing is the things naturally falling away. Tanha is this quality of trying to put more sand on under your feet, or backing up, so you have something firm to stand on. But it's a losing battle because the river's always undercutting it. And when you say, this will never change, this is who I am, then the sand gets eroded. But willing to stand on that sand, on that edge, and letting it collapse, letting yourself feel like that sense of falling, losing control. So this is really the art, is learning to relax into that falling, relax into that losing control. And in that losing of that control, then dukkha falls away. The tanha doesn't arise. And then we move into the third noble truth. So let's just sit quietly for a moment or two. Thank you.